Summer is coming and the sound of leather upon willow. We're discussing late cuts, musings on cricket. It explores the charms, the quirks, and the peculiar allure of cricket from a variety of perspectives. The author, Vic Mars, has lived a life steeped in cricket. He takes us beyond the boundary rope, sharing the parts of the game fans don't get to see, from the food served at lunchtime to the politics of the dressing room. Right, it's nice to be joining us live on the line from somewhere in the UK. I'm sure he'll tell us where. Vic Marks, author of Late Cuts. Vic, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. And I'm in the West Country. Born in Somerset, but I've lived in Devon. I'm in Exeter. So that's a very civilised place to be.
Is that as far east as you deign to go these days?
Well, I might creep as far as Taunton.
Ooh, steady now.
And if I'm feeling really bold, I suppose I could go to Bristol, but that's it. That's about it.
There'd be dragons beyond that point, I tell you now, Vic. Absolutely. Cricket has, if you like, a peculiar, and I mean that word advisedly, a peculiar part of the English or the British psyche, isn't it? There's something about cricket, and I'm not talking, you know, the big bash, I'm not talking 2020 and whatever overs, but that sort of lays back the pace that cricket has and how it reflects on life.
Maybe, particularly... Perhaps in the more rural areas. You're sounding a bit like John Major there, really.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And used to talk about, you know, the lovely greensward, and, you know, as if we were going back to the 50s. But I find myself, I mean, I've been involved with cricket all my life, luckily. And sometimes I have to fight off the notion that, you know, it's a dead sport, and that if you go to any cricket ground, there's a round of championship matches starting, I think, tomorrow, another round, that if you go to the grounds, you will find just one man and one dog. It is not quite as moribund as that. You will find that there's going to be 2,000 or 3,000 people there, and they will go and watch this, you know, the old-fashioned game that's going to start with a red ball that goes on for 4 days, and most of them will be more my age than even yours. I'm looking at you there. And people will say, well, this, but actually they keep churning in, they keep coming in. It's also become quite a modern thing in that every match, actually, every county match in England is watchable if you've got a laptop. They're all streamed. You can watch every ball of your favourite county with actually going to the ground. So it's not all moribund, but it is a bit of an oldie-worldie thing, this, you know, everyone's in white. Red ball, polite clapping, clap the opposition. There's something distinctly ridiculous in English about it, I suppose. And I'm sure if you live where you live, it has a sort of romance that we don't even recognise for those who like cricket.
Luckily we have, and I'm sitting in a studio on the Costa del Sol, and just a little bit up from where we are, we had this, a European Championships a couple of weeks at the cricket ground at Kartama with teams from the Netherlands and it was just all over the place. And it was really fascinating because for those who think, oh, well, you know, cricket is, you know, the old style cricket is almost going down the plug hole, but it was absolutely brilliant and loads of people turned up and cricket being played in places that you wouldn't think Germany, the Netherlands, were the sort of play, Italy, were the sort of places that cricket was even contemplated. But, you know, it proved wrong.
England are actually playing the Netherlands. Netherlands are quite good. I mean, they would be on the mainland of Europe. They would probably be, by a margin, the best team. And England's one-day team are going to Amsterdam. I'm going to watch them in June. To play 3 one-day internationals. And, you know, England will presumably win. But they're not bad, the Netherlands. But I know that they have all these matches within Europe. I think England, who are going through a rough time, would like to instigate a European Cup, actually, because they're short of trophies at the moment. They might just scrape in. But then they'd have to be Ireland as well. You know, the game, yes, I mean, there are strange cricket fraternities all around Europe. I played my last ever game of cricket 10 years ago, and it was an international match, and I played against France and in a sort of friendly fixture. France were on tour in 2012 in the West Country, and it was great fun. It's ridiculous. It's fun.
What's the aim behind Late Cats? Because it says in the blurb that you take us beyond the boundary rope. So you know you've been doing that. You've been doing this for a bit. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is the dietary requirements of the modern game. Because you know, I mean, we tend to think of cucumber sandwiches or breaking for tea, and if you go, one of the great things about the YouTube is you can go back and you can look at, you know, those Ashes teams and Gatting and Botham and, you know, those great sort of individuals that we had in the late 70s, Brearley, etc., Gower. And you look at them and you think that there wasn't a trainee program amongst them.
Not really, no. I mean, I joined Somerset with Ian the same day. And, I mean... Well, we did a bit of running around, and Ian was naturally fit, but he got fit by playing football and doing a lot of bowling. And he was quite active after play had come to an end as well.
That's putting it mildly, but anyway.
Whereas I mentioned in this book, you know, as a way times had changed when England went to Australia under Andy Flower, who was a sort of coach who would not leave any detail untouched. And so he sent the Australian sort of kitchens a huge 10-15 page dossier of what he expected his players to have to eat during a test match, both before they started play and after play, as well as lunch. And it was infinitesimally detailed to a ridiculous degree. And sadly, it was leaked to the Aussie press, who then had a whale of a time showing how precious this New England setup was, and their requirements were so preposterous. Anyway, it backfired in the end. But the main for the book, well, it's not to make any money, because cricket books don't make any money. I'll tell you what triggered the writing of the book. It was COVID, actually. You're marooned in your own house. You couldn't go out to watch much cricket. There wasn't much going on. Sometimes you had to watch it anyway from your television, or I was one of the few who would go to these matches in 2020 where there were no spectators, but just the media there. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and I'd written a book with the same publishers a couple of years before, and I thought, well, it's a series of essays, therefore. It's quite easy to compile a book like that. But it was more, and like a lot of cricket books actually, it was more to keep the writer sane than necessarily to entertain the reader. It was sort of therapy. But then it surfaced, and it's probably okay. And it's based on various aspects of the game that I've, you know, been part of for all my life. And food is one of them. And failure is another. Failure is a big thing in cricket. If you have a bad day in your booth there, well, it's not a disaster.
Others would come back on you that one, Vic. But anyway, but yeah.
Well, I don't think it is.
I can always hit the ad break button if it is all going horribly wrong. But
yeah. I've done a bit of broadcasting. You can get away with it. But as a cricketer, as a professional cricketer, you can be one of the better players in the world, and you are going to fail as a batsman 3 times out of 6, probably. That's not a bad ratio. So you have to get used to failing. And it's quite a hurdle to overcome, to recognize that you are going to fail more often than not, even if you're quite good. Even the best player in the world fails. Ordinary players fail 60% of the time. And bad players, God knows why they keep playing, they fail about 80 or 90% of the time. So that's it. And it's so public if you're a professional, because it's there, it's in the paper. So-and-so bowled for a duck, or a bowler 30 overs, 0 for 160. There's no escape.
Is that,
it's easier talking about it.
Is that? I mean, I always talk about there are some sports that you are if you like, you are so vulnerable to that because, you know, if you're playing tennis, you know, if you're playing centre court and it goes wrong because it's a junior game, there is nowhere to hide. Boxers, you know, if boxers are having a mare, there's nowhere there. But that walkout, and which is must be terrifying, the sledging if there are some Australians around about, and then and then that walk back must be an absolute. I mean, we talk about the physical aspects of the game and try not to get yourself too badly hurt as somebody comes, some West Indian comes hurtling towards you, but that, you know, mentally, the mental toughness, because if you're a little bit fragile when you go out, if you think you might get a bit of the collie wobbles, then that is the worst place to be.
Well, you're right, and I mean that. I mean, I was lucky to play with some of the great, great players. And the greatest of which was Viv Richards, the West Indian, who played for Somerset at the same time. And you would pay the entrance money just to watch him walk out.
Yeah.
Now, Viv came across as the most arrogant. As he walked out, he would, first of all, he would wait until the dismissed batsman had gone into the pavilion to sort of clear the stage. He didn't want any interference. And then he would strut out arrogantly and he'd be tapping the top of his bat and he'd take his time. And he would somehow manage to intimidate the bowler who just got a wicket. Whereas usually it was the other way around. You're terrified of the bowler coming in and making a fool of you. But Viv would have the bowler having sweaty palms even before he'd taken guard. And he came across as the most sort of arrogant person in the world. In fact, off the field, away from cricket, he was quite shy and extremely polite, and you know, he wasn't full of himself. He liked the quiet life out of the limelight. But you watched him go out to bat and you thought, well, this man is terrified.
I will always remember in the common room at school, we had and this dates me because it was the early 80s, but we had there was an advert, we had a poster, and it was Viv, and he was holding some, I don't know, I can't even remember what he was helping to advertise, but it said also available for mortals, because it was just,
well,
it was just,
I mean, that's saying what we felt, really. I mean, he's just turned 70, he's just had his birthday.
Wow.
And I saw a photo of him, sadly, next to Both, who was, and Viv looked like he could stride out there and get 100. He looked identical to how he looked about 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah,
magnificent physique, not an ounce of fat. And whereas dear old Ian, or Lord Botham, we must call him.
Yeah, Lord Botham, yes, of course, yes.
So, you know, he'd had back problems, he put on a bit of weight, and he was starting to look his age, dear fellow.
It's funny that you should mention Viv, because I have a list of things that I'm going to read during the show today, and one of them is Viv Richards, because Chris Cowdery, there was a story of Chris Cowdery on his first game of the England job, and he said he was very proud to be appointed the England captain. He went for the toss wearing my whites and England blazer. Viv Richards came out wearing a Bob Marley t-shirt, surfing shorts, and a tip and flip-flops. An England captain should read out the team to the opposing captain. I got no further than four names when Viv said, play who you want, man, ain't gonna make any difference.
Yeah, and he was right too. Yes, yeah. I mean, I know both of those, and Chris was captain for one match, and it was at Headingley against the great the West Indies, and he lost, and he got sort of sacked, stroke injured, then sacked after one game. But he's made the most of that one game, because he's got a wonderful, wonderful sort of after dinner routine which talks us through his one match as England captain, and that, I'm sure that's part and parcel of it.
What's it like playing with a Viv Richards? You know, like, well, I said, I mean,
it was. I mean, at its best, it was fantastic. Because for all sorts of reasons, one, you had the most privileged position. You were 20 yards at the other end. But the other thing that was fantastic about it was that even though he knew he wouldn't say so, but he was, you know, on a different plane, he kind of engaged with you, his partner, at the crease. And the only thing that I can remember that he didn't like, it would be possible sometimes for some players to go out and just play in his wake, i.e. not do anything, just say, I'm in with Viv. I don't have to try and score any runs. I'm just going to just stay there and he'll do all the stuff. He didn't like that. He wanted it to be a proper partnership and he wanted you to contribute. He wasn't a Churchillian orator, but you knew with those little mid-wicket chats that he was alongside you, thinking about you, trying to look after you a bit. And as long as you were, you know, trying to contribute, that was good enough for him. But you would be all. They bowled, you know, you would bat with him. And you'd think, well, they're bowling complete and utter garbage to him. Whereas they're really bowling quite well at him. And there might have been a grain of truth in that, because he would just, as I said, he would intimidate bowlers. Of that vintage, of that era in the sort of 80s, 70s, 80s, you talk to all the bowlers, the old pros who played in that time, and you could ask them, they will always remember dismissing two batsmen, actually. Viv, if they got Viv out, they will never forget it, and they will tell you chapter and verse. And the other, curiously, was Boycott, who was a different type of player, but he was also, you know, an extraordinary cricketer. And you'd always remember the time you got Boycott out, but also the time you got Viv out. They were the two.
Do you think that the game has changed? I mean, we've got all sorts of cricket seems to be always trying to reinvent itself for the new generation. And do you think, you know, the 100, you know, the 20, whatever, every time I come back, bright coloured outfits, you name it. We've got, of course, we've got the Indian situation with the Super League, the Premier League, whatever it is. Do you think this is a case of you don't need to make TikTok videos for cricket? You don't need to have, this sort of...
Tell me about your TikTok videos. They'll be on me.
Exactly. Well, do you think the appeal of cricket is, I mean, I love a test match because you can do stuff during, you know, you can, I mean, I love when the Windies come over, because you can, it's so entertaining, and also the crowd's brilliant, but also you sort of go, I mean, I used to go with my rugby club, we'd sit there, normally the Oval, get the lunches in, and that was the day. It was the absolute day. Rather than, you know.
Well, cricket has always changed. There have been, I mean, it has the notion of being an extraordinarily sort of conservative game. But actually, if you look at the way the game chops and changes and has evolved, both in the domestic structure in England, we've played games that are, well, 20 overs, 16.4 overs, if you want to use the 100. I mean, 40 overs, 30. You know, we've played every duration. It keeps chopping and changing because it's very hard. Unlike in football, they can't find a structure that works for everyone. So it has kept changing with remarkable speed. But the basics still remain. Now, I'm a big fan. I like T20. I love it. It draws the crowds in. It's a great atmosphere. The players have bought into it. It's enabled players to discover all sorts of different ways of playing, new shots that, you know, never dreamt of when I was playing. I'm very keen on T20. I love Test cricket. I have a real problem with the 100 because of not so much that it's the format, which is just like T20 with a few gimmicks thrown in, but the way in which it's distorted the English season, so that we haven't got two short form games, one short form game, i.e. T20, we've got two dominating the best part of the summer, June, July, August. And I think that is a problem, which might mean that a lot of young players will think, well, why bother to try and play this long game? Because I can stack some money just playing T20. But so cricket has always evolved and always changed, but, you know, what is also remarkable, if you go to a test match this summer in England, I promise you there'll be far more people in the stands playing a huge amount of money down at the Oval. Cost 100 quid to go and watch a test match at the Oval for a day. And they will be much fuller than they were in 1985, for example. So somehow in England, there is still a peculiar allure for that long game as well.
I've got this show. This particular interview is getting very interactive, by the way, because my next guest in the second hour is Clive Stafford Smith, and he says, "Glad to see you have Vic Marks on, so he's listening. His original spin book by my bedside right now. I hope that you interviewing him, Albert, will persuade him to play in my All Star 11 on May the 29th. Tell me more, Vic. Do you know about this?"
I know I'm doing something on May the 29th. I've just got my diary over here. But, well, I'm glad he's got original spin. I wrote a couple of years before this other one, which is more of a memoir.
Right.
Okay. So I'm glad. I hope he's enjoying it. Keep wading through. as for May the 29th,
I'm sure. I think it might be east of Bristol. It might be, you know. So that I think.
Well, around then, I've got to go to the Ilminster Literary Festival, and as you all know, Ilminster is just outside Yeovil. I'll go any further than that.
Well, fair enough. Tell me a little bit about, because we're going to run a little out of time in a bit, but tell me a little bit about the politics in the dressing room, because, you know, it's especially long form game. You sit around an awful lot of time. There's a lot of sort of conversation going on. I mean, you know, there's some of the bloodletting would make the Lannisters seem like a bunch of preschoolers, if you know what I mean, from Game of Thrones.
It is a curious game because it's a team game, cricket, but it's also very much an individual game. And I think in here I write about being dropped. I was dropped once by Somerset, and this was not right at the start. It's when I felt I was established in the team. And blow me down, the captain said, "Look, we're leaving you out this match." I couldn't believe it. And so you have this dilemma. Because obviously you've got to show a bit of loyalty and you want the team to win. But you also want the team to win in a way that demonstrates that the captain had made a terrible mistake at the start. In fact, the game I remember, we lost. And I was brought back for the next match. But you have to sort of, you can't be too blatant about your joy at the fact that it's not going according to plan. And you have to try not to, you know, let everyone know too, obviously, that the reason we've lost this match is because the captain picked the wrong team. The other thing about those dressing rooms is that, you know, you are locked away with the same players for 6 months of the year minimum. So you get to know them. And that's, you know, that can be really, really rewarding. Just occasionally it can be a real pain in the neck. And in a good dressing room, we had a good dressing room, which disintegrated a bit towards the end of my time at Somerset. We had such a variety of characters, and that kind of kept us going, you know, from Ian at one end of the scale, a chap called Peter Roebuck, who fell out with Ian in the end, but was big mates with him to start with. Viv, we had guys from Oxbridge, we had guys who were sort of tool makers from Froome or whatever. And it was a wonderful, looking back, it was a wonderful sort of variety of cricketers who, when it clicked, it didn't matter where we were all from, when it clicked and we were lucky to have some good players, it was rather wonderful. And when it all went sour, it was terrible. It did go sour for a couple of years. We haven't got time for that, sadly.
So where was your favourite place to visit? Where did you like playing cricket? What was the ground that you went to? that's a wheel weary sigh there, Vic.
Well, let's have a think. I haven't got a stuck answer to this, but I mean, one of my proudest, but this is, I actually spent a winter playing in Western Australia for West Australia, which is unusual for an Englishman to do that. So, and I played at the Wacker, the famous Wacker in Perth, which is one of the quickest wickets. And it was odd for a spinner to go there, which is what I was. But they needed someone to play in the Eastern States. So there I was at the age of about 30, playing with all these 6'6" Aussies on the bounciest, fastest pitch in the world. But because they were a good team, I did rather well. I sort of blended, you know, gave them what they... And so I have very fond memories. I feel like I'm an honorary West Australian. And we won the Shield. We won the Shield that year. So I have an affection for Perth, based not on architecture or beauty, but the fact that I went there at a great time for 4 or 5 months I did it. I had two seasons there actually in the end. And so I'll pluck Perth, Western Australia, out in the wilds there, you know, miles from anywhere else.
And after the recent England performances over, you know, with the Ashes, et cetera, we've got an awful lot of, we're in one of those you know, navel glazing, retrospective, reflective periods that we always find ourselves in. So yeah. Do you see a shining light at the end of the tunnel, Vic? Is there any hope?
Well, there's always hope. Yeah, yeah. No one hopes like a cricketer, I can tell you that. And it's quite exciting in that, obviously, it's chaos at the moment. At the ECB, there's no chairman, there's no chief executive going, there's no cricket director, they're just about to appoint one. They've made Ben Stokes captain. Now, I think you can argue to the cows come home whether this is a good appointment or not, whether he's going to end up like Botham and Flintoff, which didn't work, or whether... But there is one obviously good thing about Stokes being captain, is that Stokes is a big name, a great cricketer, high profile. So whatever happens, it's going to demand the attention of the sporting public, which is a good thing for the game. Stokes being captain of England is quite an exciting prospect. So I'm not all despair, really. It happens. It goes in cycles. But Stokes being in charge will be a source of fascination, and there'll be more interest in the game as a consequence. So that's not a bad thing.
That can be no bad
even
thing.
Even in especially probably in southern Spain.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it will make the front pages, etc., etc. Give us something. This is something to argue about over our Sundowners, Vic. You must admit, and you must come over here and check out the situation at Cartama with the Spanish cricket, because I think that would be a good reason to come and visit, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
The book is called Late Cuts, Musing on Cricket. It's by Vic Marks, who we've been speaking to today. Vic, do you do the social media thing, or is it just best to find some of the stuff that you've written online?
I've just sort of withdrawn as a full-time journalist, but I was about the only journalist that doesn't engage in Twitter or anything else, I'm afraid. So, and I'm a Luddite in that regard. Well, or I choose not to.
Indeed. Well, are they the book will be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore for a start, so they can get their hands on it.
Yeah, well, that'll do. Whatever that means, sounds good.
That sounds good, and it's perfect accompaniment for a long, hot summer of English cricket. The book is called Late Cuts, Musings on Cricket. It's by Vic Marks. Vic, thank you so much for your time today.
Bye-bye.